Hello, my name is Haru.
And my name's Dave.
And we'll be reading the business editorials and opinions of the Cincinnati Enquirer for Sunday, November 10th, 2019. The business articles that I will read are the following: War Hero at War with Author of Book by Jack Greiner, Refinancing Student Loans Right for You by Sean Piles, Healthcare Options for an Early Retirement by Amy Wagner and Nathan Bachrach. And today's cover story in the business section is FCC scored solid TV ratings, but this article was written by Alexander Coolidge of the Cincinnati Enquirer. FC Cincinnati finished its inaugural season in Major League Soccer in last place, but it scored big time versus other soccer teams in television ratings. While the team drew only a fraction of the TV audience as Cincinnati's established pro teams, FC Cincinnati was the third highest watched professional soccer team in 2019, according to Nielsen. More than 12,000 local households tuned in to watch FC Cincinnati during the 34 games played between March and October, according to Nielsen. Nielsen gave FC Cincinnati a 1.5 HH rating. That means the team drew 1.5% of 828,000 viewing households in Cincinnati. Nielsen didn't disclose ratings for the 23 other Major League Soccer teams. The Cincinnati Reds averaged a TV audience more than three times FC Cincinnati, with 5.1% of households, indicating an average of 42,000 local households, according to Nielsen. The Cincinnati Bengals commanded a 27.1 HH rating, indicating nearly 225,000 households tune in, an 18-to-1 advantage over FC Cincinnati ratings. FC Cincinnati's local ratings did beat viewing of other established sports on television. It edged out the National Hockey League's semifinals. They drew twice the local number of households watching NASCAR racing and five times the viewers as broadcast from golf's PGA Tour. We're excited about where we are and the growth that is ahead for both the team and MLS, said Vince Cicero, FC Cincinnati's senior vice president of partnerships and broadcasting. Cicero noted the local ratings don't include viewership via streaming services, Flow Sports within the region, and on ESPN Plus outside of Greater Cincinnati. He added, seven of the 34 games were nationally televised, so they reached an even broader audience. Local sports and media pros said the numbers were a solid start for a newbie team, especially when compared to other soccer teams. For a new team to rank that high among their peers, it shows there's a lot of interest in the team and how they perform, said Alicia Cintron, a sports administration professor at the University of Cincinnati. It's a promising start, agreed Bruce Druschel, chairman of the Media Journalism and Film Department at Miami University. So how do FC Cincinnati ratings compare to other programming it competed against during the season? The answers reflect the splintered audience. Jeopardy averaged more than 85,000 local households, drawing more than 10% of the local audience, nearly seven times FC Cincinnati's draw. Wheel of Fortune won 5.7% of households. Judge Judy was viewed by 4.3% of local audiences. Aside from local news, FC Cincinnati's other toughest competition came from reruns such as How I Met Your Mother and Two and a Half Men, which averaged less than 1% of local households. For the latest on Cincinnati business, P&G, Kroger, and Fifth Third Bank, follow at Alex Coolidge on Twitter. Dave?
Rue, I've got four syndicated columns this morning. David Iglesias writes about how the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has badly tarnished his reputation. Catherine Rampell writes about Elizabeth Warren trying to do Bernie Sanders' work and failing. Mark Thiessen editorializes, why don't Democrats just censor Trump? And Kathleen Parker has a column on Justice Clarence Thomas. It's entitled, Justice Thomas Tells His Special Story. If we have time, we'll do a little letters to the editor. But the front page story today on the forum section is written by Ms. Laura Bruner, who is the president of an organization entitled The Port. She's president and CEO. Her editorial is entitled, Why the Port Mends Broken Real Estate. Editor's note, Taking Ownership is a series of monthly editorials written by the Port president and CEO, Laura Bruner, that puts forth strategies on how Cincinnati can be a place where everyone has a chance to participate in prosperity. A public intermediary for Hamilton County Development, the Port, balances multiple interests to make real estate work for everyone. The Port's role in revitalization, especially in light of deep historical disparity between African Americans and whites that I described in column one of Taking Ownership, is critical. But still, are we often asked, what are we trying to accomplish? What is our job? What is rarely considered is what would happen if the Port were not here. The Port was created as a public independent city-county entity to conduct economic development projects and programs on behalf of Hamilton County jurisdictions. It was designed for state lawmakers to fill a need the public and private sector could not do alone. 10 years ago, the Port was redesignated to fully manage complex, large-scale projects and help solve the region's most difficult challenges. Every Ohio Port Authority functions a little bit differently. Ours is a real estate organization focusing on three areas: neighborhood, commercial, industrial, and large-scale projects benefiting from public ownership and niche financing, like several downtown parking garages and Queen City Square. I became the CEO in January of 2012, and soon after, the Port began managing the newly established Hamilton County Land Bank. Stabilizing neighborhoods ravaged by the housing crisis became an intermediate priority. The condition of neighborhoods like Evanston led us to take bold action. In addition to our work throughout the country, we committed to an intensely focused in a few neighborhoods at a time, performing gut rehabs of vacant properties at a financial loss in order to kickstart dormant housing markets, acquiring hundreds of foreclosed properties to get them back into responsible ownership, and working collaboratively with organizations already on the ground. What people may not know as much about is our industrial site strategy. In 2015, we pivoted from helping private industrial landowners obtain and manage state cleanup grants, which had largely gone away, to acquiring and controlling the redevelopment of industrial sites ourselves. Why? Because our region lost 100,000 manufacturing jobs from 1969 to 2015, parenthetically, that's from UC Economic Center, and when those jobs went, it largely hollowed out our middle class. Shuttered factories are vacant or have turned into warehousing or storage facilities. The Port pays more to acquire and redevelop sites than we can recoup later in the property disposition. Sites like one we are considering now, the 25-acre former Dow Chemical plant in Reading, pose cost, risk, and require expertise beyond what the private sector can or will take on. When Dow vacated in 2014, it represented a loss of 230 jobs with an annual payroll of more than $10 million. We share a regional vision that Cincinnati will reclaim a dominant national position for manufacturing. Our role in bringing back thousands of manufacturing jobs is by redeveloping 500 underutilized industrial acres. REDI, Cincinnati cannot meet national market demand here for large, development-ready sites. Due to our lack of shovel-ready sites, our region routinely must turn away business. The common thread that weaves through the port's work is real estate, making it productive and creating civic and social benefit through equitable redevelopment. Real estate needs to produce tax revenues, house families, provide jobs, and opportunity for entrepreneurism. If the port were not doing this work, one bullet point, there would be the continued loss of our manufacturing strength because of the chronic lack of modern manufacturing sites ready for development. Bullet point two, residents living near the former Hutapol Brewery in Queensgate would be subject to compromised air quality from the Superfund site. The former 25-acre Dow site in Reading would continue as an underutilized brownfield comprising the city's future health and stability, and Amberley Village would still be trying to revitalize the former Gibson Greetings site, where the obsolete building was being used for storage and distribution. Blighted neighborhood properties on the four-footed land list would continue to be sold in a, quote, lottery-type system without regard for community plan or resident opportunity. Available for about $50, the property buyer may or may not be attuned to the community's goals. And the third bullet point, blighted business districts would continue to negatively impact neighborhood opportunity and contribute to food deserts and lack of access to other vital neighborhood service businesses. It is fair that everyone has access to opportunity to participate and share in the prosperity of Cincinnati's economic comeback. It will not happen without efforts to make sure there are multiple, quote, on-ramps afforded to African Americans and to other historically left-out groups. Next month, I will describe these efforts and how to find opportunities to own a piece of your neighborhood. Again, Laura Bruner, the author of this editorial, is president and chief executive officer of The Port. Haru?
Thank you, Dave. Our next business article is titled, Refinancing Student Loans Right for You. This article is written by Sean Piles of Ned Wallet. Glossy mailers promising low rates and cleverly crafted ads on your favorite podcast might leave you wondering, should you finance your student loans? With over $1.6 trillion in student loan debt in America as of March 2019, student loan refinance companies have an incentive to entice you, and a lower payment sounds alluring. But is refinancing the right move for you? 1. Dig into your finances. Before you make a big change to your money management, such as refinancing your student loans, fully understand your overall financial picture, says Barbara Thomas, Executive Vice President of Southeast Bank. This will ensure you're coming from an informed place so you can make the best decision for your situation. The more solid your footing, you're paying all bills on time, you're putting away savings, and you still have cash left over at the end of the month, the more likely it is you could qualify for a refinance and handle any financial changes it brings, Thomas says. Make sure you've done all the reconnaissance work in terms of what your obligations are, what your credit scores are, and what makes and make sure you understand your financial outlook. Start with a simple monthly budget like the 50-30-20 approach that allocates 50% of income to needs like housing, 30% to wants, and 20% to debt payments and savings. Then list your student loans, noting balance, annual percentage rate, and loan term. Check your credit and correct any errors on your credit reports. 2. Look at your loan type. Next, turn your attention to your loans themselves. Are they federal or private? Federal loans carry options and protections such as income-driven repayment plans and loan deferment that you lose if you refinance them into private loans. Almost nobody should refinance their federal loans, says Betsy Mayotte, founder of the Institute for Federal Loan Advisors, an organization offering free student loan guidance. The only people who I recommend doing that are those who have a very strong emergency fund. There are simple income generators in the household, and their payment is really affordable to begin with. 3. Define your goals. Finally, look at what you want out of a refinance. A lot of borrowers are looking to pay off their loans faster, Thomas says. Their monthly payments may go up, though. Then some borrowers are looking to lower their monthly payment overall by lowering APR and extending their loan term. If you want a lower payment, make sure you look at the overall financial implications. A higher APR, longer loan term, are both mean you'll end up paying more in the long run. Here's how that breaks down. Say your current balance is $30,000 with a 7% APR and 10-year term. If you get a refinance deal with a 5% APR and kicked out the loan term to 15 years, you'll save $111 a month, but you will pay about $900 in additional interest. If you're looking into refinancing because you're paying off federal loans, you have other options such as income-driven repayment plans and extended repayment plans. Those can make monthly payments more manageable, but again, you'll pay more in the long run due to a longer loan term. And 4th, are you sure about refinance? Make yourself look good to lenders. So you've done your homework and determined that refinancing might be a good option for you. Before you apply, make yourself look even better to lenders. Thomas says the lowest credit scores lenders will accept for a refinance deal would be around 640 to 680. But you'll likely get the best deals with a score of 720 or higher. And lenders may want to see 2 years of on-time repayments on your existing loans. If needed, spend some time building your credit and extending your record of on-time payments. And hedge expectations created by the glossy mailers. Unless you're the cream of the crop, the advertised rate is probably not the deal you're going to get, May Yoti says. Dave?
First Syndicated column this morning is written by David Ignatius. His editorial is headlined, Pompeo Has Badly Tarnished His Reputation. Dateline, Washington. Since the investigation began into President Trump's machinations in Ukraine, one of the most disturbing questions has been, where's Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, who's supposed to shield his diplomats from political interference? And now we have the answer. Pompeo, in recent months, has essentially been in hiding, protecting himself while his subordinates took the hit, evidently hoping to preserve his influence with Trump. Sometimes his deflections and denials have been outright misleading. Pompeo has badly tarnished his reputation in accommodating Trump. He joins a long list of those damaged by their service to this president. If you're someone like me who thought Pompeo was one of the smarter and more effective people in the administration, it's a sad moment. This harsh judgment is nearly inescapable after reading the transcripts released Monday of testimony from two key department officials. Marie Yovanovitch, a 33-year-old Foreign Service veteran Trump fired in May as ambassador to Ukraine, and Michael McKinley, a 37-year veteran, who resigned in October as Pompeo's senior advisor because, quote, the disparagement of a career diplomat, Yovanovitch, doing her job was unacceptable to me. At the core of Pompeo's story is the conundrum of what public service means under an erratic president like Trump. Pompeo's defenders argue that he might serve his personal interest by resigning and protecting what's left of his political career. Pompeo's defenders argue that his story is more complicated than it appears. They say that though 2018 and early 2019, as Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani was spinning malicious falsehoods to undermine Yovanovitch, Pompeo had a senior deputy press Giuliani for evidence to support his charges. Giuliani never produced any, and Yovanovitch stayed until Trump personally demanded she be fired and Pompeo acceded. In the lead-up to her firing and following the publicity over her dismissal, Yovanovitch kept asking for support from her bosses. That was especially so after Donald Trump Jr. tweeted in March that she was a, quote, joker who should be sacked. Pompeo was mum, quote, "What I was told was that there was concern that the rug would be pulled out from underneath the State Department if they put out something publicly," Yovanovitch testified. In late April, she was ordered home. Acting Assistant Secretary Philip Reeker told her that, quote, "The secretary had tried to protect me but was no longer able to do that." And Deputy Secretary John Sullivan informed her she was fired. "I said, what have I done wrong?" And he said, quote, "You've done nothing wrong." Pompeo did not explain or apologize. His counselor, Thomas Ulrich Brechbel, refused Yovanovitch's request for a meeting. Trump's groundless attacks on Yovanovitch continued, as did Pompeo's silence. We learned months later that Pompeo had listened in on the infamous July 25th call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in which Trump asked for a political favor in exchange for sending Javelin missiles to Ukraine, and described Yovanovitch as, quote, "bad news," warning that she was, quote, "going to go through some things." Pompeo did nothing. When a transcript of the meeting of the menacing July call was released on September the 25th, Yovanovitch felt personally threatened, and she again asked for help. Pompeo said nothing public in her defense. McKinley, the senior advisor, pressed Pompeo to issue a brief statement of support for Yovanovitch. Quote, "He listened. That was it, sort of. Thank you. That was the limit of the conversation," McKinley testified. He went to see Pompeo twice more in the few days, the last time to resign, telling Pompeo, quote, "The situation is not acceptable." Pompeo told ABC News last month that not once did McKinley say a single thing about his concerns about Yovanovitch's treatment. By McKinley's sworn testimony, that statement was false. What is character? It's hard to define, but as NPR's Scott Simon recently noted, a good short summary is the West Point motto, quote, "A cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do." We should be careful not to judge others' character, especially in the hot box of Washington. But it's deeply troubling to see a powerful person like Pompeo, who is silent in the face of lies and who takes no action to protect his subordinates from wrongdoing. Haru?
Thank you, Dave. Our next business article is titled "Health Care Options for an Early Retirement." This article is written by Amy Wagner and Nathan Backrack. Our first question comes from J.G. in Loveland. "I would love to retire early, but my employer doesn't offer health care for early retirees. What are my other health care coverage options?" Answer: this is one of the main factors anyone retiring before age 65 needs to think through. What am I going to do about health care until I'm eligible for Medicare? In your case, we're not entirely surprised your employer doesn't offer health care coverage. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, a nonpartisan research organization, only one in four employers offer the option to early retirees as of 2017. Here are five more possibilities you can consider. One, if you're married and your spouse is still working, see if you can join his or her plan. Retirement typically counts as a qualifying life event, meaning you're eligible for a special enrollment window. Two, check out the Affordable Care Act online at healthcare.gov to compare public plan options. Just be ready for some sticker shock. A new report from eHealth shows the average monthly premium for those between ages 55 and 64 has risen to $799. However, in some cases, if your retirement income is low enough, you can qualify for a subsidy. 3. Look into buying a health plan directly through an insurance company known as private insurance. Consider working with an insurance broker or using a comparative website such as GoHealth. 4. If you're okay with the idea of still working a little in retirement, consider a part-time job at a company that offers benefits to part-time employees. Examples include Lowe's, Starbucks, Costco, and UPS. And 5. In the event you were forced to retire, COBRA, that's C-O-B-R-A, allows you to keep your current group coverage for up to 18 months. However, this option is usually fairly expensive because you're paying your full premium with no employer assistance. Here's a Simply Money point. It's good that you're thinking this over now while you still have time to make plans. Just be sure to do your research. All these options come with different coverage availability and cost. Our next question comes from Chris from Fairfield. My parents were told they need to take something called an RMD by the end of this year, but they're not sure what that means. Can you help? Answer. RMD stands for Required Minimum Distribution. It is an annual withdrawal the government forces anyone age 70 and a half and older to make if they have money saved in a tax-deferred account, such as a traditional 401k, traditional IRA, 403b, or SEP IRA. The account holder must withdraw a specific amount of money as determined by an IRS life expectancy calculation by December 31 of each calendar year in most cases. Otherwise, the IRS will hit them with a hefty fine of 50% of the amount they were supposed to withdraw. If you're thinking that doesn't seem fair, the government has its reason for forcing your parents to make these withdrawals. Remember, the money they're taking out has been sitting in an account that's tax deferred, meaning they received a tax break on contributions and earnings have been growing tax free. Since no taxes have been paid yet, Uncle Sam wants his cut. It's time to pay the piper and pay tax on the distributions. The good news is that it's usually not a high percentage that needs to be taken out in earlier years. It's likely less than 4% of the balance. The Simply Money point is that your parents need to make their RMD withdrawal a financial priority soon. If they work with an advisor, he or she should be able to help them figure out how much to withdraw. If they don't, an online calculator or worksheet can assist with the calculation. Every week, Allworth Financial's Nathan Bachrach and Amy Wagner answer your questions in their Simply Money column. If you, a friend, or someone in your family has a money issue or problem, feel free to send those questions to yourmoney@inquirer.com. Responses are for informational purposes only, and individuals should consider whether any general recommendations in these responses are suitable for their particular circumstances based on investment objectives, financial situation, and needs. To the extent that a reader has any questions regarding the applicability of any specific issue discussed above to his or her individual situation, he or she is encouraged to consult with a professional advisor of his or her choosing, including a tax advisor and or attorney. Retirement planning services offered through Allworth Financial, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Securities offered through AW Securities, a registered broker slash dealer. Member FINRA slash SIPC. They can be reached at 513-469-7500, or you can visit them at their website, which is allworthfinancial.com. Dave?
Second syndicated column this morning comes from Catherine Rampell. Her column is entitled, or headlined, Warren tried to do Sanders' work and failed. The most positive thing you can say about the health financing plan from Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat of Massachusetts, is this. She failed. She failed in an impossible feat. The feat was getting the math on Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders' specific version of Medicare for All to add up, which means offering more generous coverage than currently exists anywhere on earth in a country that likely has the highest health care prices and still somehow saving the country money in the process. Sanders' Medicare for All plan, like his entire political career, is arguably more about pushing the Democratic Party leftward, not coming up with real implementable policies, or at least not doing the homework required to determine if his proposals are real implementable policies. Yes, Sanders loves to talk about how he, quote, wrote the damn bill on Medicare for All, but he has not even attempted to figure out its financing. That would require him to document his claim that middle-class Americans will come out ahead financially even if their taxes go up. Warren, on the other hand, decided to construct a detailed financing plan for Sanders' proposal. Why she boxed herself into her rival's bill is unclear. Medicare for All is a popular brand, sure, but it's a vague slogan that means different things to different voters, and polling suggests Sanders' particular interpretation of that slogan, which includes eliminating private insurance, is not actually a political winner. Plus, as Warren herself pervasively argued back in January, there are, quote, lots of paths to get to universal health coverage, which is the broad objective voters care about. These paths do not all require shunting everyone into single payer. In fact, there are, quote, lots of paths to get to single payer that don't look like Sanders' specific version of single payer. These include considerably cheaper proposals that, as in the existing Medicare system, have some modest cost sharing, such as through income-based premiums. Warren is also a deft communicator and an imaginative, even visionary, policy wonk. Yet, she still decided to hitch her wagon to his idea. So Warren did Sanders' homework for him, and she determined that in order to pull off Sanders' promises, you need to make some extremely generous assumptions on both sides of the ledger. On the cost side, Warren takes existing independent estimates for how much money in a given proposal would save and then ratchets them up much higher. For instance, the Urban Institute recently estimated that a single-payer system might cut drug costs by 30% from commercial prices. Warren instead suggested she'd cut payment rates for branded drugs by more than double that. We felt we were making pretty optimistic, aggressive assumptions, said Linda Bloomberg, a health economist and co-author of the Urban Institute analysis. Quote, they're making more optimistic and more aggressive assumptions. On the revenue-raising side, Warren likewise proposes some ideas that might be good on their own merits, but then dramatically overstates their impact, increasing the enforcement budget of the Internal Revenue Service, for example, is a no-brainer for raising tax revenues. But Warren's plan says it would raise 40 times as much money as the Congressional Budget Office estimates. Likewise, however, little sympathy you might have for the billionaires subject to her 6% annual wealth tax, the Warren team's projection for how much money it would raise, beggar belief, given foreseeable tax evasion and avoidance. Eventually, she's going to run out of billionaires to tax, and she'll have to reach into the pockets further down the income ladder. The peculiar thing is this. If you stripped away the most inflated, least convincing assumptions in Warren's proposal, it could, in fact, raise enough money to get us to universal coverage without a single-payer system. Heck, we could even pay for a version of single-payer that looks more like merely expanding the existing Medicare program to all Americans, a proposal the Urban Institute has dubbed, quote, single-payer light, and that has income-based cost-sharing and Obamacare-style minimum benefits. Good job, Senator Warren, in attempting to do Sanders' homework for him. It showed us what a fool's errand his plan is. But we'd all be better served if you used your talents to come up with a different assignment. Haru?
Thank you, Dave. And our last business article today is titled War Hero at War with Author of Book. This article is written by Strictly Legal's Jack Greiner. Woody Williams is a World War II veteran who received a Medal of Honor in recognition of his service at Iwo Jima. He is 96 years old and a plaintiff in a lawsuit against Brian Rigg. Rigg is a historian who has spent the last 4 years researching a book about the Pacific Campaign in World War II. Rigg did extend research on the book and interviewed a number of veterans, both American and Japanese. He met Williams through this process and interviewed him numerous times. As the book evolved, Rigg decided to spend considerable pages talking about Williams and Japanese General Taramichi Kuribayashi. As Rigg's attention focused on Williams, he unearthed some unflattering information and inconsistencies in some of Williams's accounts. Williams was not pleased with this development and generally was upset that the book did not reflect the tone that Williams wanted. Williams also believed he was entitled to money for his participation. Riggs offered to donate some proceeds of the book's sales to a foundation Williams had founded, but ultimately no agreement was reached. Williams filed a lawsuit seeking to stop the release of the book on several grounds, including a claim that the book violated Mr. Williams' right of publicity. Riggs recently filed a motion to dismiss the complaint. The right of publicity is a right recognized in many states. The right is designed to protect the commercial value of the names and likenesses of famous figures. The right protects against an injury to the pocketbook of a celebrity who contends that he should have been allowed to profit on the sale of his likeness or performance. The right of publicity is designed not to provide privacy, but to ensure that an entertainer can still profit. In a simple example, if a retailer used a photo of Joey Votto in an ad without Votto's consent, that would be a problem. Williams seems to think Riggs' book is similar to that ad, but that assumption may not be accurate. Traditionally, the right of publicity cannot stop the free dissemination of thoughts, ideas, newsworthy events, and matters of public interest guaranteed by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. So the right does not extend to writings about public figures or matters of legitimate public interest. As one commentator wrote, courts long ago recognized that a celebrity's right of publicity does not preclude others from incorporating a person's name, features, or biography in a literary work, motion picture, news, or entertainment story. Only the use of an individual's identity in advertising infringes on that persona. There are some compelling reasons for this principle. Riggs notes in his motion that allowing the right of publicity to prevent historians from researching and writing biographies of historical figures would be catastrophic. That is why courts routinely hold that any right of publicity does not extend to unconsented works of an individual's life story, such as an autobiography. Any other result would allow historical figures to hold history hostage. Potential subjects could either set an exorbitant price for the use of their name and image or demand that history be altered to fit whatever narrative they have developed. Either outcome would be unacceptable. We'll see what the court does with this case. But as much as we appreciate Mr. Williams' service, this is a lawsuit that would be better off dismissed. That article was written by Jack Greiner. Jack Greiner is managing partner of Graydon Law Firm in Cincinnati. He represents Inquirer Media in First Amendment and media issues. Dave?
The next syndicated column comes from Mark Thiessen. Why don't Democrats censor just censor Trump? Is his title. Dateline Washington. On January the 20th, 2017, the Washington Post reported that, quote, the effort to impeach President Donald Trump is already underway. Even before Trump took the oath of office that day, Democratic groups were looking for a pretext to remove him from office. They thought they would get one from Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Instead, Mueller found that Trump did not conspire with Russia to steal the 2016 election, but rather than capitalize on that moment of vindication, Trump decided to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory and give Democrats the pretext they had been looking for by asking Ukraine to investigate Hunter Biden. Democrats cannot believe their luck. Unlike Russia, this time Trump actually did something wrong. The president's phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was not, quote, perfect, as Trump repeatedly claims. A USA Today Suffolk University finds that only 30% of Americans believe there was nothing wrong with the call, but the same poll finds that just 38% thinks it was an impeachable offense, while 21% say it was wrong but not impeachable. That means most Americans agree with Democrats that Trump did something wrong, but only a minority believe that his misconduct rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. Worse still for Democrats, according to an Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research poll, 53% of Americans believe that their impeachment inquiry is politically motivated. So, unless some bombshell evidence emerges to turn public opinion decisively in favor of impeachment, Trump will not be removed from office. Impeachment would be a purely symbolic act, so why not drop impeachment and censor him instead? There is precedent for doing so. In 1834, the Senate voted to censure President Andrew Jackson, whose portrait Trump has proudly hung in the Oval Office, over his stonewalling of a congressional investigation into Jackson's decision to shut down the Second Bank of the United States. If Congress voted to censure Trump, it would make him only the second president in history to have been so explicitly reprimanded. The House could easily pass such a censure resolution and might even do so with a bipartisan majority. Right now, House Republicans feel no pressure to vote for impeachment, and Senate Republicans feel no pressure to convict, because most Americans agree with them that Trump's conduct is not impeachable. They know that, if anything, impeachment poses a greater political danger to Democrats, putting at risk 31 House seats held by freshman Democrats in districts that Trump carried in 2016. But by censoring instead of impeaching the president, Democrats could easily turn the political calculus against the GOP. The Post reports that a growing number of Republicans are ready to acknowledge that the president did use military aid as leverage to force Ukraine to investigate the Biden family, but that, quote, the president's action was not illegal and does not rise to the level of an impeachable offense. To oppose a censure resolution, Republicans have to argue not just that the president's misconduct does not rise to the level of an impeachable offense, but that there was no misconduct at all. Clearly, there was, and Americans know it. Censure would put public opinion squarely on the Democrat side and put Republicans in a political bind. A bipartisan censure vote would ultimately be more damaging to Trump than impeachment along party lines. The impeachment inquiry is energizing Trump voters who believe Democrats are trying to invalidate their votes by removing Trump from office. Censure would take away that argument. It would be dispiriting to Trump's base, especially if some Republicans join Democrats in voting to rebuke the president. The Senate would not be required to take up a censure resolution passed by the House, but so what? Jackson's censure was passed by only one House of Congress. If the House censured the president and the Senate failed to even vote on the resolution, it would look very bad for Republicans. Will Democrats do it? Probably not. Their ravenous base wants to brook no compromise. But because impeachment will be nothing more than an act of censure anyway, why not actually censure Trump and pressure some Republicans to vote against their president? Then leave the decision of whether to remove Trump from office where it belongs in the hands of the people next November. Haru?
Well, our next article comes from Cincinnati.com. This article is titled, Forgotten Soldier 10 Years After Fort Hood. It's a rather long article, so I'll read it as best I can with the time we have left. I'll read it in two sections, rather. A Forgotten Soldier 10 Years After Fort Hood. On November 5th, 2009, a U.S. Army major killed 13 people and injured more than 30 others at a military base in Texas. Many of the victims are remembered at a memorial there. This is the story of one man who survived the shooting but could not survive life afterward. He killed himself in 2013. He is not memorialized. From a military evaluation of Joshua A. Berry in 2011. Present condition and current functioning. After the Fort Hood shooting, Sergeant Berry developed severe PTSD symptoms, including a recurrent nightmare in which he is a passenger in a Chinook helicopter under fire in Afghanistan, when another passenger in the aircraft suddenly turns his gun on the service member and starts firing. He also reported short-term memory problems and a reduced capacity to attend and concentrate. He started getting worse while driving in familiar places. Sergeant Berry was irritable, easily frustrated and depressed. He had little appetite or energy and was unable to sleep. He was transferred to Fort Knox WTU soon after the shooting. The soldier was unable to tolerate an inpatient PTSD program at a private hospital near the base, and he was allowed to go to remote WTU status in order to be treated at the Cincinnati VA MC Partial Hospitalization Program, PHP. While he derived much benefit from the group and individual psychotherapies offered at the PHP, trials of a number of different medications were ineffective in improving the soldier's anxiety, symptoms, or depression. This story has a start in a cemetery on a cold day when Howard Berry was standing at a grave. It could be the grave of his son, who he buried in 2013, and visits at least once a week. Sometimes Howard wears his son's camouflage army jacket, and underneath, if it's cold, he'll probably be wearing a black sweatshirt mocking the Department of Veterans Affairs. Dysfunctional veterans, it says on the front. On the back, giving you another chance to die for your country since 1930. Howard is 63, and his wife tells him he spends too much time in cemeteries. When he's there, he might place a penny on his father's grave and a red I love you button on his son's marker. He's probably tired or angry, or both. If asked to explain, he says no one gives you a playbook for what to do when your son hangs himself at age 36. Howard will tell you after his son's death, he took Josh's medications to a drug drop-off box and had to come back another day because there were so many. But Howard might not be at his son's grave. Chances are, if you see him in a cemetery, he'll be at a stranger's headstone. And if there is a military designation, sometimes even if there isn't, he will bend down and place a metal rod in the ground. When he pulls it out, he'll place a small American flag into the grass. He'll do this over and over, often for hours and hours. Howard will likely be by himself over the objections of his wife, and this probably won't be the first cemetery of the day. At some point, he'll take a step back and smile. That looks pretty good. That's something he would say as his flags flutter in the wind. And if you drive by and ask what he's doing, he will tell you. He might tell you his son was a veteran, failed by the VA and the country he fought for. He might tell you about his son's nightmares or how his son's marriage fell apart because of post-traumatic stress disorder. He might tell you his son loved Skyline Chili and the Cincinnati Reds, but he couldn't stand crowds after 12 years in the military. He might tell you about a picture of his son, arm in a sling, shaking hands with President Obama. He might tell you this picture was once the proudest moment of his son's life. And if he tells you that, he'll tell you it eventually came to symbolize all the ways his son felt left behind. He might even tell you his son killed himself with the number to a suicide hotline in his pocket. Howard would tell you hundreds of veterans kill themselves each month. He would tell you most people don't know that, and that the flags he puts into the ground are his way of honoring the service members society would rather not discuss. Dave?
The fourth and final syndicated column this morning comes from Kathleen Parker. It's entitled, Justice Thomas Tells His Very Special Story, Dateline Washington. Nearly everyone who has an impression of him, and most are mistaken. For if they knew Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas better, they'd most likely be celebrating and naming streets after him. Thomas is an American hero, born to nothing. He grew up knowing only hard labor and unyielding discipline, episodes of deep faith, years of searing anger, and stints as a seminarian and a college revolutionary. Ultimately, he graduated from Yale Law School and earned a seat on the highest court in the land. And yet, because he's a conservative, a sin especially grave to someone because he's black, and because he opposes Roe v. Wade, he is reviled by many who, were he ideologically otherwise, would herald him as a triumph of individual will and grace over seemingly insurmountable odds. This is the takeaway from a new documentary about Thomas, who granted director Michael Pack full access. The two-hour film, quote, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in his own words, is a distillation of 30 hours of interviews in which Thomas tells his story, close up and personal, as if sitting across the table. It is a marvel of filmmaking that 2 hours pass so quickly. At the end of a screening I recently attended, there weren't many dry eyes in the room. While most Americans know Thomas either from his Supreme Court confirmation hearings in 1991, when Anita Hill accused him of inappropriate comments at work, or as the justice who almost never asks questions during oral arguments, he is certainly much more than what those two dusty narratives portray. Some will have read his memoir, quote, My Grandfather's Son, and be familiar with the facts of his story. Born in Pinpoint, Georgia, the descendant of West African slaves, he lived with his mother and two siblings in a one-room shack without plumbing. But hearing him talk about that distant life and the hardships that formed him is an intimate, often heart-tugging experience. You meet a man who was always different, always questioning, and determined to succeed no matter what, and who suffered greatly without complaint. His mother once told him that as a baby he was too stubborn to cry. At age 71, Thomas seems at ease, expressing feelings long hidden from public view and casts a wry eye on some of his formative years, such as when he joined a group of black radicals at the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts. We're supposed to be revolutionaries, he said. So you go to the local Army-Navy store in Worcester, and you get Army fatigues and boots. Why that was the dress is beyond me, but that's the way we dressed, he laughs. His attraction to radicalism was foreshadowed when, while earlier attending a Catholic seminary, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was shot. A fellow seminarian said, quote, That's good. I hope the son of a bitch dies. Quote, And that was pretty much the end of me. That was it, said Thomas in the documentary. He abandoned seminary. When Senator Bobby Kennedy was murdered a couple of months later, Thomas says he suddenly saw everything in terms of race and racism. Anger swiftly followed. Quote, I'm angry with the church. If it's a warm day, I'm angry. If it's a cold day, I'm angry. I'm just angry. After leaving seminary, Thomas returned home to his grandparents, with whom he and his brother had lived since Thomas was 7 years old. His grandfather had imposed high standards on the two grandsons. Days were filled with labor from sun to sun. When the boys first arrived in 1955, their grandfather told them that the door on his house swung both ways. It swung inward for them on that day, but if they misbehaved, it would swing outward, and he would ask them to leave. Upon Thomas's return from seminary, the door swung outward, and his grandfather told him to leave. Quitting seminary wasn't merely disappointing. To his grandfather, it was quitting, plain and simple. Thomas would have to find his own way from there. And you, dear reader, will have to wait for the rest of the story until May of 2020, when PBS plans to air the documentary. Audiences will learn why Thomas rarely asks questions and why he never gives up. A clue can be found inscribed on a bust Thomas keeps of his grandfather, who often said to the young Clarence, quote, "Old man Kant is dead. I helped bury him." Haru?
Thank you, Dave. Now, the conclusion of the article titled "Forgotten Soldier 10 Years After Fort Hood." From a psychiatric medical board evaluation of Josh in 2011, the event led to a dramatic improvement in Sergeant Barry's psychiatric status. Was the birth of his daughter during the summer of 2010. He was very happy to take on his new role as father and proudly showed other veterans in the PHP program the pictures he had of his newborn daughter. Unfortunately, several weeks after she was born, the service member's wife sent him a text message stating that she was leaving him due to her discomfort with his ongoing symptoms of PTSD. Sergeant Barry then suffered a marked deterioration in his psychiatric status that ultimately led to his being hospitalized in October of 2010 after his neighbors pulled guns on him when they found the SM walking around the neighborhood in full combat gear. He was discharged a week later on Tegretol, Haldol, Cogentin, Xanax, and Vistaro. Sergeant Barry continues to have nightmares every other night, but he can now fall back to sleep a few minutes after awakening. He's now getting about 7 hours of sleep a night. The soldier is also coping better with his daytime flashbacks and memories. After Memorial Day this spring, more than 7 years after his son's death, Howard drove to Columbus. He was scheduled to speak to an Ohio House of Representatives committee in support of a marker on Interstate 71 acknowledging veteran suicides. I went with him. In the car, we didn't listen to music or the radio. We just talked, or more precisely, Howard talked. I'd heard a lot of stories before. Dave?
Well, we have time, I guess, for at least one or two editorials or letters to the editor.
We've got a minute left.
Okay, I'll read just one.
Okay.
It comes from John Halk from Milford. His letter is programmed to help prevent evictions is a major step. A stable home is the first step in achieving a reasonably prosperous and productive life for one's family. Cincinnati's eviction prevention plan is an admirable legislative effort to provide renters with a safety net to maintain a stable residence. But the rental registry, tenant information page, and rental inspection program are not what are most important. Rather, money is always the major issue. A tenant either has the money to pay the rent or he does not. And based upon a tenant's ability to pay the full rent, the tenant either is evicted or he is not. Thus, the city's allocation of $227,000 is a major step toward providing financial assistance to renters. Thank you for doing this. Your data for the first 3 months of the program show that 62,000 or slightly more than one-fourth of your budget was expended to assist renters. On the other hand, 540 persons applied for assistance, with 97 households, or 18%, actually receiving assistance. This suggests that you could go much further in funding the program, but at least you have made a great start. Combine this program with more funding for affordable housing, and you may, in fact, achieve a real benefit for the citizens of Cincinnati.
And that concludes our reading of the business editorials and business sections of the Cincinnati Enquirer for Sunday, November 10th, 2019. This is Radio Reading Services. My name is Haru.
My name's Dave. Good to be back with you, Haru. We'll be back next week with more from the world of business and editorial opinion.